This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Katie Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights joins us.
She is handling a case of Iraqi men who were tortured and abused at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison.
We'll also speak with appellate attorney Kathy Manley, who also had a recent victory in the case of the so-called Newburgh Four.
Once again, in the post-9/11 climate, government overreaching and outrageous conduct is on display.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. In April of 2003, the George W. Bush administration led an illegal invasion of Iraq based on lies about weapons of mass destruction. That war resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. After the invasion, there was a mass roundup of Iraqis, primarily men and boys, with no plan or proper basis for detention. The United States then turned to contractors or mercenaries to assist with the interrogations and provide interpretation services, many of whom lacked proper training. Indeed, the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were the most outsourced in U.S. history. It was against this backdrop that the horrors we all saw in the photos of Abu Ghraib happened. In Iraq, unlike Guantanamo and the CIA black sites, there was never any question that the Geneva Conventions applied and that torture was illegal. CACI, a U.S. corporation, contracted with the United States military to provide interrogation services to the U.S. Army at Iraq's notorious Abu Ghraib prison. In 2008, Iraqi civilians Suhail al-Shamari, Salah al-Ejalii, and Assad al-Zubayi filed a lawsuit against CACI under the Alien Tort Statute, seeking damages for the torture and abuse they suffered while detained at Abu Ghraib. The three plaintiffs allege that CACI employees conspired with and aided and abetted U.S. military personnel in subjecting them to torture, cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment, and war crimes in violation of international law. A U.S. Army general called their treatment sadistic, blatant, and wanton. On July 31st, U.S. District Judge Leonie Brinkema in the Eastern District of Virginia rejected CACI's attempts to have the case dismissed. Catherine Gallagher is a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where she specializes in the enforcement of human rights, including the prohibition against torture. She is one of the attorneys who filed the lawsuit against CACI. We are thrilled to have Catherine with us today on Law and Disorder to discuss this important victory in the historic case against CACI. Catherine Gallagher, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
What did Judge Brinkema rule on July 31st?
Well, the case that we're talking about, al-Shamari v. CACI, is a very long-running case. It was filed back in May 2008, and there are three plaintiffs who are all subjected to torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment at Abu Ghraib back in 2003-2004. So this has been a very long-running litigation, and what Judge Brinkema ruled at the end of July was that the defendant, CACI, or CACI, a private military contractor that had provided interrogation services at Abu Ghraib, the case against CACI could proceed. CACI has filed almost 20 motions to dismiss this case over the last 15 years, and it had two more that it filed in 2021 and 2022. In Judge Brinkema's latest order, said that these motions, which relied upon recent Supreme Court decisions, some of which were wholly irrelevant as a matter of law to the case brought by the plaintiffs, one of which involved the law that the case is brought under, the Alien Tort Statute. Judge Brinkham had ruled that these Supreme Court cases did nothing to alter the prior findings that this case could proceed to trial.
Katie, what are your clients alleging that Kaki did to them? Didn't Defense Department investigators conclude that Kaki interrogators and U.S. military personnel abused detainees at Abu Ghraib?
Indeed, back in 2004, when those notorious photos from Abu Ghraib were made public, we learned that there had been an investigation by a military general, General Taguba. And in that investigation of conditions at Abu Ghraib, he found that detainees were subjected to sadistic, wanton, inhuman abuses at Abu Ghraib. And he found that there had been private military contractors from two companies that were implicated in the abuse. As the years went on, more revelations came out about the role of the contractors. These individuals who were hired quickly and deployed over to Iraq to fill the shortage of military involved after the roundup of just so many tens of thousands of Iraqi detainees. These improperly trained and improperly supervised contractors are alleged by our clients, Suhail, Assad, and Saleh, to have stepped into the command vacuum that existed at Abu Ghraib and to play a role in giving instructions and orders and advising the military police to, quote, soften up and prepare detainees at Abu Ghraib for interrogations. And in so doing, they employed methods that have long been found to constitute cruel and human degrading treatment and torture. So these private military contractors in their positions as interrogators are alleged to have participated and aided and abetted a conspiracy to torture detainees at Abu Ghraib.
Your client's case against Kaki has been ongoing for 15 years, as you said, and it's the last remaining lawsuit brought against U.S. military contractors, also called mercenaries, for their role in the Abu Ghraib torture. Can you briefly tell our listeners what has happened in your case since you filed it and what is scheduled to happen next?
Sure. So maybe just to start first with what happened to our clients and why they brought this case. Our clients, Suhail, Assad, and Saleh, like so many other Iraqis, were rounded up and detained without charge at Abu Ghraib after the U.S. occupation and invasion of Iraq and the ensuing insurgency against that occupation. And so, for example, one of our clients, Saleh El-Ajali, he was a journalist working for Al Jazeera, and he showed up as a journalist to do reporting on an IED explosion along the side of the road. And as a journalist, and arguably and potentially because he was a journalist, he was arrested, well, he was detained by the U.S. Military, and he was placed in detention at Abu Ghraib. And while in detention, Saleh and Assad and Suhail and so many others were subjected to forced nudity, being kept naked for days and days while hooded. They were threatened with dogs, deprived of food, beaten, including their genitals. And I should say that sexualized torture and abuse were something that we have heard a lot of instances of at Abu Ghraib and other detention centers. Our plaintiffs were kept in solitary confinement. They were subjected to sensory deprivation, manipulation of the temperatures, either being kept very cold or very hot. And through their own suffering, they also would overhear the abuse being subjected on other detainees, which itself was quite terrifying. So after they were released, and all of them were released without charge, they learned about the cases that the Center for Constitutional Rights and other lawyers had filed on behalf of another group of Iraqi detainees. Unfortunately, we lost the very first case that we brought against private contractors on behalf of Iraqi detainees. We lost that case back in 2009 in the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And I flag this in part because at that time, Judge Brett Kavanaugh was in the majority dismissing the case, and Judge then Merrick Garland wrote the very strong dissent in favor of the plaintiffs. But this case was filed, as we said, in 2008. And over the course of the 15 years, CACI has presented certainly a vigorous defense, which defendants are entitled to, but they have really taken the same core arguments and packaged them again and again and again, boiling down to saying that because we were a government contractor working with the United States, we shouldn't be held accountable. And they have argued that because the violations occurred in Iraq outside the territory of the United States, that, again, they shouldn't be held liable. So there have been many names and labels put on the legal defenses they've raised, like the political question doctrine or the government contractor defense or the presumption against extraterritoriality. They've also questioned whether or not corporations can be held liable under the law that we use, the 1789 Alien Tort Statute, a law which allows non-U.S. citizens to come into federal court and assert a violation of the law of nations or international law. So we've been up and down repeatedly to the Court of Appeals defending our clients and their claims in this case. And throughout the 15 years, we have kept this case alive, and the courts have found that this is a valid case. So Judge Brinkema's latest ruling in July, we hope, will finally again bring us to the brink of a trial date. So we are hoping that at a hearing on September 8th, we indeed get that trial date and that these three men finally get their day in court in Alexandria, Virginia.
Katie, do your clients still suffer from the treatment they were subjected to at Abu Ghraib? Were they ever charged with crimes?
Just to answer the second part first, no, none of them were charged with crimes. And in fact, none of the 338 former detainees I've represented over the last 17 years in these cases, none of them were ever charged with crimes. In terms of their suffering, it's very difficult. I think first to just explain what torture is. Torture is the severe physical or mental suffering that a person is subjected to. And in this case, we had both physical and mental harm. So serious physical or mental harm is the legal definition. While some of, or most of the physical scars by this point have healed, and I think there are remnants, not just remnants, there are literal scars that you would see from the abuse. It's the mental piece that is really difficult. All of our clients have been diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and to this day can suffer from nightmares and just fear being brought back to that time and place. And I really want to commend our clients for continuing to pursue this litigation, because it's not easy. To bring these cases means that, you know, over the course of many years, they are called upon to remember some of the most difficult and painful and terrifying moments of their life. And it could be that they go through a period of weeks or months where they're able to compartmentalize and get on with their life, and then I'll call and give news like the July 31st decision and the fact that, you know, we hopefully are going to trial. And while that is, of course, good news, it also means that they have to go back to nearly 20 years to the time of and the place of their torture and abuse.
I, Marjorie Cohn, and my co-host Heidi Boghossian are speaking with Catherine Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights about her clients who have sued a U.S. corporation for torture and abuse at Abu Ghraib. Katie, under the Fourth Geneva Convention and the U.S. torture statute, torture constitutes a war crime. You told us about the Alien Tort Statute and how it applies to this case, but what is the law of nations, and how can a U.S. court have jurisdiction over actions that happened in Iraq?
Sure. So the Alien Tort Statute uses the term the law of nations for the kinds of violations that a non-U.S. citizen can come into court, a federal court, and assert. That terminology is the terminology used when that law was passed in 1789, and it is understood now to be international law. And so the way that we determine what the current modern contours of international law to be, it can be treaties, it can be customary international law, and the Supreme Court has looked at that language of law of nations, and it has determined that the kinds of claims that are actionable under the Alien Tort Statute are claims that are specific, obligatory, and universally recognized. So that is the kind of specificity for international law violations that we can assert. And indeed, torture is one of the core violations of international law. It has its own treaty, the Convention Against Torture, which the United States is a signatory to. It is also, as you mentioned, included as a war crime under the Fourth Geneva Convention. It's also well recognized as a crime against humanity under customary international law and in international statutes that codify crimes against humanity. So there isn't much debate, indeed there's no debate, that torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment are core violations of international law, and that they can be claims brought under the Alien Tort Statute. What we've seen over about the last decade is a challenge to what had previously been recognized in the cases since the Filartica v. Peña Arala case in 1980. That case, that Filartica case, set a precedent that non-U.S. citizens could assert violations of international law or the law of nations in U.S. federal courts, even when those violations occurred overseas and all of the parties involved were non-U.S. citizens. In the last decade, the Supreme Court has narrowed the kinds of cases that come into U.S. federal courts under the ATS. And that is part of what CACI has been challenging since we had the Supreme Court decisions in a case called Kiobel in 2013, a case called Jessner in 2018, and then a case called Nestle in 2021. And this current Supreme Court does have a certain aversion to international law and applying that law not only broadly, but I would argue as the Alien Tort Statute and the founders intended in 1789. And the historians who've looked at this law have found that the purpose of the law was really to show that the United States would allow non-U.S. citizens to vindicate their international rights, particularly when a U.S. defendant was involved. So here we have CACI, which is a U.S. corporation that's headquartered almost down the road from the courthouse in Virginia. And so we think it's absolutely appropriate for a U.S. court to be reviewing violations against a U.S. corporation. And what this latest decision by Judge Brinkema found when she was looking at the facts of our case against the Supreme Court decision in Nestle is that this is an appropriate domestic application of the Alien Tort Statute because there are a lot of areas of conduct, a lot of the conduct by the corporation to aid and abet and otherwise further the torture and abuse that actually occurred in Virginia, whether that was the hiring, whether that was the review of how their employees were doing on the ground, their engagement and involvement on a day-to-day basis and making trips back and forth between the United States and Iraq, their promotions, and then their response once news started to break that there were investigations going on at Abu Ghraib. So all of these pieces, as well as, again, the fact that this is a U.S. corporation under contract with the U.S. military, operating at a U.S.-run detention center in U.S.-occupied Iraq, this is an appropriate case to be brought under the Alien Tort Statute.
What are your clients seeking in this lawsuit?
This is a civil action, so the normal course of action in a case like this for redress would include damages, you know, financial compensation for the harms that they've suffered, and indeed that is the outcome that we hope that they receive after a trial. I would say it's also about a historical record. I don't want to downplay, of course, the legal applications and outcomes in this case and the fact that they are seeking damages. But this is also to have their day in court in Virginia and have the U.S. public really understand what happened to them, who they are, and as torture survivors themselves, a motivation for bringing this case is to ensure that this kind of harm does not happen to others in the future. That is a strong motivating factor for them.
Katie, didn't the U.S. military try to cover up the torture and abuse at Abu Ghraib?
What we saw with the investigations that happened after the photos came out was really widespread condemnation. We saw that condemnation by the American public. We saw that condemnation by Congress. We saw that condemnation from large parts of the military. And indeed, we even heard that condemnation from George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld. And I think it's important to highlight that Iraq is a place where there was never a question that the Geneva Conventions applied. So this was not a place where the U.S. was saying, oh no, we can go torture, it's okay, the law is fuzzy. This is a place where everyone there, contractors included, was supposed to abide by the Geneva Conventions, Convention Against Torture, and the Prohibition Against Torture. So the condemnation of the conduct that happened there and the fact that it was not authorized is all part of the record. What we saw in terms of investigations is we saw that the court-martials were largely of the low-level military police and military interrogators at Abu Ghraib. We didn't see that the investigations, or at least the prosecutions, went up the chain of command, though there have been a number of reports that really detail the conditions that allowed what we would say is this command vacuum where the contractor stepped in.
Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, who was in charge of Abu Ghraib, but who was the torture was kept away from her, when she found out and saw those photographs of the torture, she wanted to hold a press conference immediately and apologize to the Iraqi people. And she was told by her higher-ups, no, they actually covered it up. And finally, those photos started leaking out. And then, as you said, there was widespread condemnation, including from the people at the top of the chain of command.
Mm-hmm. How can our listeners support this case, and how can they follow your important work?
You can follow this case through CCR's website, ccrjustice.org, and we have a case page, El Shamari v. Khaki, and that has a lot of the filings in this case, and it also shares information about the plaintiffs and some of the interviews that they've done. So I would really encourage folks to check that out and follow it there. And in terms of support, I think one of the things that really matters to the plaintiffs is that Abu Ghraib is not forgotten. We're coming up on the 20th anniversary next year in April 2024 of those photos making their way into the public eye. And it's almost 20 years in the coming couple of weeks that our clients started to be detained there. And when I go out and I speak at schools, especially colleges or even high schools that I've done some talks at, people aren't aware of Abu Ghraib. And for many of us who lived through that time, and certainly for our clients, it's something that it's shocking that it's forgotten. So I think to continue to share information about what happened and to say that this can never happen again is also a very important thing for your listeners to do.
Well, Catherine Gallagher from Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you so much for your critical work, and thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. On July 25th, a judge ordered the compassionate release of three of the so-called Newburgh Four, Onta Williams, David Williams, and Laguerre Payen. The men, who are black Muslims from Newburgh, New York, were convicted and sentenced to 25 years in prison on terrorism charges in 2011. In the July release order, U.S. District Court Judge Colleen McMahon suggested that the FBI had, quote, invented a conspiracy. She said that FBI agents had used a, quote, unscrupulous operative to persuade the four men to join in a plan to bomb a synagogue in the Bronx and fire Stinger missiles at military planes at Stewart Airport near Newburgh, New York. While bombs were, in fact, left outside a synagogue in the Riverdale section of the Bronx, they were fakes built by the FBI. Joining us to talk about this late and coming victory is New York appellate attorney Kathy Manley. Among her many victories was the 2015 case of People v. Diak, which struck down county and local sex offender residence restrictions throughout New York State. Kathy works with several civil rights groups, including the Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms. Kathy, welcome to Law and Disorder, and congratulations.
Thanks, and thanks so much for having me.
Kathy, Judge McMahon said that rather than being sophisticated international terrorists committed to jihad against the United States, the three defendants were, quote, in actual reality, hapless, easily manipulated, and penurious petty criminals. Can you please elaborate on your clients' backgrounds?
Sure. I mean, they were definitely impoverished black men from an impoverished community. They had some different circumstances. Laguerre Payen, who I actually represent, is extremely mentally ill and had just gotten released from ICE detention because of his mental illness. He managed to avoid deportation because he was so severely mentally ill, and he was just basically struggling to survive, looking for food. David Williams was trying to get his life back on track after getting out of prison. was taking some classes at a community college, and I think he had a part-time job. On to Williams. I'm not too sure, but they had all been in prison before for minor things, and they were all just trying to survive. James Cromedy was kind of a small-time con artist and was actually trying to con the informant in this case out of money. And, well, we know who got conned in the end, by the government.
How did you originally come to be involved in the case of the Newburgh Four?
Well, I was one of the attorneys for Yasin Arif, who was also targeted and unfairly convicted in an FBI sting operation in Albany, New York, where I live. And after he lost his case and was sentenced to 15 years, he and his co-defendant, in 2009, we heard about this other case, and we realized pretty quickly, thanks to some reporters digging around, that it was the same informant, Shahed Hussein, that they used in the Albany case. So we were interested right from the start, and as we learned more about the case, we realized how outrageous it was. We went down and met with their lawyers, and we weren't too involved, but we attended part of the trial and tried to help the lawyers a little bit. And unfortunately, they got convicted, and they lost their appeal, although there was a dissent at the Second Circuit. But then we didn't stay too involved. We advocated for them and spoke about them and the unfairness of the case, but there wasn't much we could do until after the First Step Act went into effect in 2019, which allowed for the filing of compassionate release motions.
Before we get to that, Kathy, for our listeners, can you explain, if you will, why this case was so egregious?
Sure. It was, I think a lot of these sting operations that the FBI has been doing, mainly since 9/11, where they're going to target mainly Muslims who have really no interest in terrorism for the most part, or maybe they've said they're upset about the U.S., actions abroad, invading countries and droning people and torturing people, and maybe they've said some things, but they didn't have any real plans or anything like that, and they get targeted in these sting operations, and it's very unfair. But these guys, they weren't even had no interest in any of this stuff. All they wanted was the money, and jobs and cars and everything that this informant promised them, mainly the money. So that's sort of the definition of entrapment, somebody who's not really interested in committing a crime and the only thing that they want is the money. And you would think that they would have won on an entrapment defense, but that's not the way the law works. There really is no entrapment defense anymore because, I don't know if you want me to go into that now, but basically the government has to show that they were, if they offered the money or something, they have to show that they were predisposed to commit the crime. And the way they can show that now is if they offer the money and they say yes and they sound interested in it, that can count as predisposition when it's clearly not predisposition. It's just a reaction to the manipulation and the, what they call inducement from the informant. So, but the way that's defined, that means that there basically is no entrapment defense anymore, and it's outrageous, and this case is one of the worst examples of it.
Kathy, set the scene for us politically during the arrest. How did the post-9/11 shift to preventive policing factor into their prosecution and convictions?
Sure. After 9/11, the FBI was, trying to prevent more attacks, but basically they didn't care how they went about it, and they had this idea, which turned out to be completely wrong, and that there was sort of like a sleeper cell army of people in the U.S. wanting to do more attacks, and that was not true at all. There wasn't a shred of evidence for that, but they started trying to prevent anything basically by sort of the 1% scenario that Dick Cheney talked about. If there's a 1% chance that someday these people might do something against the U.S., then we're going to prevent them from doing that. We're going to preempt them, and we're going to go after them in one way or another. And, sometimes it's immigration charges, deportation. Sometimes it's sting operations. Sometimes it's other things. But they did a lot of sting operations, targeting people who were not trying to do anything. and just in, on the off chance that maybe there was a chance they might someday want to do something based on their protected speech or who knows what. In this case, it was just like a show trial. They just tried to find anybody who was interested in the money.
Kathy, let's talk a little bit more about the informant, Shahed Hussein, and his role. Steve Downs, an attorney from Project Salaam, has called him a brilliant con man. And you mentioned inducements. Can you tell our listeners what the inducements were and how that worked?
Sure. So, well, Shahed Hussein, he got into this work because he was facing years in prison for fraud with the DMV, fake driver's licenses, and he faced a murder charge back in Pakistan where he would have been deported after serving a prison sentence. So he definitely was interested in saving his skin by working for the FBI, and he did that in our case, in the Albany case. And apparently, even though he committed a lot of perjury there, the FBI wanted to continue using him, so they sent him down to Newburgh to just look for targets. He actually found James Cromedy in the parking lot of this mosque because the people in the mosque had basically not wanted anything to do with him. They realized he was bad news in one way or another, and he was out in the parking lot and found James Cromedy, started offering him all sorts of money. James, you know, is trying to con him, and Shahed Hussein's telling James, oh, I'm a terrorist, you should work for me and you can make lots of money, and James starts lying and spinning all these tales about how he's a terrorist too and he's committed a bunch of bombings. Completely false. He's never done anything violent. He's just trying to get the money. So I think the FBI had authorized him to offer James $5,000, and you know, and he offered $5,000 plus a whole bunch of cars and jobs. And at one point, James was avoiding him because he decided he didn't really want to be part of this. He didn't really like this guy, and he wasn't getting the money yet. You know, he was just getting a lot of promises. And then, so he avoided him for months, and then Shahed Hussein gets him on the phone again and says, listen, brother, I promised you $250,000. You don't want it? So James says, oh, I'm in. That offer wasn't even authorized by the FBI. But, I mean, for these guys, really, the $5,000 in most cases would have been enough. Maybe in James's case it wasn't quite, but in any event, Shahed Hussein didn't know that he was being recorded by the FBI on that because he had shut off his own recorder. He didn't know he was on the wiretaps. At the end, they wanted three more people, and so they basically reached out and found three people at the last minute, offered them $5,000 each if they would participate in this plot, and they clearly just wanted the money. James just wanted the money. That's what it was all about.
Shahed Hussein, the informant, did not record the first meetings with James Cromedy. The other three were brought in at the end. And when Hussein did start recording, the FBI unusually allowed him to switch the tape off and on. What does that say to you?
Well, I mean, this is a pattern in these FBI sting operations, not just with Shahed Hussein, where the initial meetings are not recorded. And so when the informant is working on these targets and trying to get them to go along with something, and who knows what they're saying and what they're promising or how they're manipulating them, we never really find out. I mean, we hear, you know, the defendant's versions of it, that sometimes they'll say they were threatening them. But anyway, that's generally not recorded. And so I think that is kind of an FBI strategy to do it that way. And then they finally, when they get them to a certain point, then they'll start recording it. And Shahed Hussein was very tricky with the recorder in our case and in this case and in probably any case he's been involved with, because he's been in some others too. And he would just kind of shut it off or, quote, lose it, unquote, whenever he felt like it, maybe when things weren't going quite the way he wanted, when the people were saying things that would have not looked good for the government's case. And the FBI doesn't seem to mind working with this guy. They seem to like him. In fact, in the Newburgh trial, he was on the stand for a long time, and he committed perjury so much that the judge pointed it out, And she actually wrote a letter to the prosecutors up in Albany and said, it looks like he committed perjury, and this relates to his bankruptcy case, because he had a bankruptcy case up in Albany at the same time period that he's saying that he was, when he's on the stand in Newburgh, he's saying that during that same time period when he declared bankruptcy, he was getting like hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Pakistani government. Who knows what the reality was, but he was saying this. He just is basically a pathological liar. But of course, the prosecutors up in Albany, they didn't want to prosecute him. You know, he's their star witness. And they actually kept using him after this, you know, after he had committed all this perjury. And they sent him to Pittsburgh for another sting case. So he just kept doing this work, and then eventually he started a limousine company up here near Albany. And tragically, he did not maintain the limousines, and one of them had bad brakes, as was known to Shahed Hussain and his son, I believe. And Shahed Hussain was actually out of the country when this limousine crashed and killed 20 people in 2018. Shahed Hussain never came back after that, left his son to face charges. His son's now serving a manslaughter sentence in that case. But I think the FBI enabled him to destroy a lot of people's lives, and including the 20 people that got killed that day.
Tragedies all around with this. Kathy, at trial, prosecutors painted the four men as America-hating terrorists bent on slaughter. We know you've said that's not an accurate characterization, but in your mind, did they stand any chance of getting a fair trial in that post-9/11 climate?
Probably not. I mean, we were really hopeful because it was a somewhat diverse jury. It was down in Manhattan, the trial. They had good lawyers. And they didn't show any interest in terrorism. And they also had nothing to do with developing this plot. Every bit of it was created by the FBI with Shahed Hussain. They picked the targets. They had the fake missile that they were using. They drove them around, like, scouting. These guys didn't even have driver's licenses, let alone cars. They couldn't even find the Google Maps of the targets on the Internet. They contributed absolutely nothing to this. They just wanted the money. And that was really clear, and we were hoping that the jury would find that they were entrapped. But again, because the judge followed the law the way the entrapment defense has developed, or I should say the lack of entrapment defense, the judge told the jury that if the people didn't withdraw from the plot, if they responded to the inducement by agreeing to it, basically that showed that they were predisposed. So, you know, if that's the way the law works, then there is no entrapment defense, and that's a huge problem.
We're speaking with Kathy Manley, attorney for the Newburgh Four. Kathy, you filed the motions a year and a half ago when you realized the three could seek a reduced sentence. What were the grounds you raised?
Yes, so originally the compassionate release provision was intended for people who had terminal illnesses or just really severe disability in prison. But when the First Step Act was passed, it allowed for a compassionate release motion directly to the judge, whereas before it had to go through BOP, and they would never grant them even for people who were terminally ill. It could go directly to the judge, and very importantly, it could be granted for what's called any extraordinary and compelling reason. So that kind of threw things wide open to deal with cases that were clearly very unfair, but where, as here, the law didn't allow them to win on appeal, basically, because the way the entrapment law was, and they lost their appeal. So once that went into effect in 2019, and I learned that you could do it for any extraordinary and compelling reason, I thought of these guys, because we had been thinking about them for years. And I actually wrote to them in January of 2020, to the four of them, saying, I'd like to do this motion for you. And I wrote to James twice because he never responded. That's why he wasn't part of the motion. I think he may get some relief from it now. But so the other three we represented, myself and two other attorneys. But we didn't do it in 2020 because then the pandemic happened right away, and we decided to focus on people who were at really terrible risk from dying of COVID in prison. And so we did a bunch of those motions for a year and a half, and then we worked on these motions and we filed them. And then they were pending for a year and a half. And then the judge, after I had started to lose hope because it took so long, where nothing was happening, and I just thought, oh, she's never going to decide this or she's going to deny it. And then we got this great decision on July 27th, and it was really good news. So she did stay it for 90 days, so they get released 90 days after that, so October 24th.
Kathy, can you just explain something you mentioned? What is the STEP Act?
Oh, the First STEP Act. That was a law that was passed in Congress in, actually it was passed in 2018, and it allowed for a few different things, criminal justice reform, but the biggest part of it, well, for these purposes anyway, is to allow for the filing of compassionate release motions for any extraordinary and compelling reason. The extraordinary and compelling reason in this case is that the sentence was, well, I believe they never should have been prosecuted, but the extraordinary and compelling reason, the reason she granted it, was that the 25-year mandatory minimum sentence that was determined by the government, the way they charged this case, that was way too long, and the judge knew that all along, and she had said things like that at times, but she didn't feel legally that she could avoid imposing it until we filed. Well, she didn't avoid opposing it. They served most of it. They served 14 years, but by the time we filed, you know, they still had a lot of time left on their sentence, and she was able to say, okay, this is an extraordinary and compelling reason that this mandatory minimum sentence was way too long, and so now I'm going to grant their release.
And in fact, in her 28-page decision, she referred to that sentence as unjust. Kathy, we have a few minutes remaining. Has the FBI softened its tactics over the past few years?
Well, what they've been doing, these guys never, you know, had any interest in, they clearly just wanted the money, never had any interest in terrorism whatsoever, or even any interest in any political ends, or they were not upset about anything that was happening in the world to, I mean, they probably are, but, you know, that wasn't their impetus for this case. And what the FBI usually does is they'll target sort of young, alienated men, often Muslim, often with mental illness, in fact, who are upset at things that the U.S. is doing in the world, which there's a lot of things to be upset about that I'm upset about and we're all upset about, but the FBI targets young Muslim men, and they send an informant to them, and they convince them to participate in some kind of plot that the government creates. And so they're still doing that, you know, and a lot of these guys are mentally ill, and that's one of the things that bothers me the most, because the FBI knows that. They're taking advantage of that. And some of them are so mentally ill that they get declared incompetent for trial. And if you know the standard, I mean, that's a really hard standard. You have to be really severely mentally ill to be declared incompetent for trial. And some of the guys that have been targeted and convicted in these sting operations, well, or charged and indicted in these sting operations, have been declared incompetent for trial. And then sometimes they'll, you know, give them a lot of drugs and then bring them back and then convict them and sentence them to, you know, 25 or 30 or 50 years or sometimes life, depending on what the charges are that the government created, because they're all fake cases. And so, yeah, I wouldn't call that softening their stance. I mean, they're still doing this stuff. Not quite as much lately since, you know, ISIS got defeated in Syria, but it was a lot of the cases were dealing with that for a while, but they're still doing it.
Kathy, you were involved in another case concerning two other men convicted in a similar FBI sting in Albany 2 decades ago. Can you briefly tell us about that?
I'll try to be brief, but yeah, 2004, Yasin Arif and his co-defendant Mohammed Hossein were arrested and charged in this really elaborate and super unfair sting operation using the same informant. And it was just basically a loan from the informant to Mohammed Hossein, who needed money. So he was entrapped by taking this loan, which there was some vague talk that it was like money laundering of the proceeds of the sale of a missile, but he didn't really pay any attention to that. There was no, like, he had no interest in that, and he made that pretty clear. But Yasin, my client, was just brought in to witness the loan, as often happens with Muslims. They don't charge interest, so they'll witness loans, and it's actually in the Quran. So that imams often do that, and Yasin was an imam, so he did that. He didn't think there was anything unusual about that because he did it all the time. He did think the informant was kind of strange, but wasn't really paying attention to any of the stuff the guy said. He would sort of drop these hints that something illegal was going on, but Yasin didn't actually know anything illegal was going on, and even said so on the tape that he didn't think anything illegal was going on. But because of classified evidence that was false, we found out they had him mistaken with someone else. And we've never actually seen this evidence to this day, even though the lead trial attorney who I was working for at the time got a security clearance, never got to see the evidence that was given to the judge. And based on that evidence, we believe it's false because later we found out they had him mixed up with somebody else who died. But anyway, the judge told the jury that the government had good and valid reasons for targeting Yasin. So, of course, even though there was really lack of evidence that he even knew anything illegal was going on with witnessing this loan, they were afraid to acquit him because that's what the judge, not even the prosecutor, but the judge was telling him, that there were good reasons for going after this guy. So here's a Iraqi Muslim, very religious, with a beard soon after 9/11. They're not going to acquit him. And they didn't. And they acquitted him of most of the counts, but not all of them. And so he and his co-defendant both got 15 years. They're thankfully released now, but they had to serve those sentences entirely. We tried and tried. We were never able to get them out before that. But Yasin was released and is back, and he got deported. He's back in Iraqi Kurdistan, and myself and my colleagues visited him in January, and he's doing great, and his family's doing great, and Muhammad's out and living in Albany, New York. He's doing pretty well. He had some health issues. So they survived, but boy, it took a huge toll on their lives and their family's lives and the community's lives. It scared the community because they knew these guys were innocent, and they knew if it could happen to them, it could happen to anybody. So it made the whole Muslim community afraid to speak out against injustice. There's, you know, informants swarming all over the place. It's still going on, maybe a little bit less now, but it's still going on.
Well, Kathy, your valiant work on behalf of so many of these innocent persons framed up really inspires us here at Law and Disorder. How can our listeners follow your work?
Okay, so I work with, and thank you for that, I work with the Coalition for Civil Freedoms, CCF, so you could look, civilfreedoms.org is our website, which we're in the process of revamping our website, but that's our website, and we're also on Facebook, so people could go there, and we advocate for a lot of these people and bring the family members together and support the prisoners and, you know, just do whatever we can for them.
Well, thank you so much, Kathy, and have a wonderful rest of the week.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you.